Get 12 weeks of The Spectator in print and online for just £12. And we'll give you a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to Spectator Out Loud. I'm Fraser Nelson. Every week we ask a few of our writers to read their pieces from the magazine. On this episode, Katie Balls talks about Scotland, not just the stramash north of the border, but how a number 10 infighting might even lose the union. Then Matthew Lynn tells the story of the up crash. Why have markets been soaring while the economy has been tanking? And finally, and you really must listen to this one, Craig Brown reads his fantastic review of Samantha Markle's memoir. It's currently the most popular piece on the Spectator website. Pretty much everyone who's come on the website has read it. And he talks about a memoir where, as he puts it, resentment oozes from every line. First up, Katie Balls.
At the stroke of 5 o'clock last Friday, the new head of Number 10's union unit was due to brief government aides on the robust new strategy to counter the SNP. It was urgently needed. Campaigning for the Scottish Parliament election starts in a few weeks, and if Nicola Sturgeon wins a majority, as looks likely, she'll demand another independence referendum. If granted, or she finds a way through regardless of Westminster's response, she stands a chance of winning. Any plan to save Britain must be put into action sooner rather than later. But an hour or so before the briefing, an email went around to say it was cancelled. What's more, its author, Oliver Lewis, had resigned just 2 weeks into his job as head of the unit. Explanations for his departure started flying around Westminster. Lewis is a protege of Dominic Cummings, and his departure, some say his purging, was seen by many as part of the unfinished civil war with Boris Johnson's former advisers. Whatever the truth, the psychodrama sent a clear message that the SNP may be vulnerable, but the Tories are too busy feuding and briefing against each other to take full advantage. Oliver Lewis had an aggressive strategy to combat the SNP, but it wasn't his approach that was a problem. The heart of the trouble was the arrival in Number 10 of two advisers, Henry Newman and Simone Finn, both are allies of Michael Gove and close friends of Carrie Simmons, the Prime Minister's fiancé. Vote Leave allies warned of the growing influence of Simmons, while other aides fretted about over the loyalties of the Goveites. A Number 10 spokesperson was forced to deny that the Prime Minister's fiancé was secretly running the country via aides invited to soirées in the Downing Street flat. A briefing war soon broke out over the behaviour of Dylan the dog, which only served to show the nation how easily distracted the government is. The soap opera might have been funny, but the situation not so serious. A focused effort could deny Sturgeon a majority in May, and without a majority, the Scottish Parliament could not vote for a referendum. She is fighting off Alex Salmond in Edinburgh, who has accused her allies of conspiring to have him sent to prison. Accusations don't get much more serious. But despite the severity of her situation, Sturgeon doesn't appear too worried. SNP politicians were quick to recognise the chaos in Number 10 on social media. Part of the current muddle stems from the fact that there's no clear structure. As well as the Number 10 union unit, there is a Cabinet Office's union directorate, led by Michael Gove. Gove wants to love bomb his fellow Scots, blowing kisses from the other side of the border. Lewis had advocated a more muscular, take-no-prisoners approach to the SNP. No one is sure what the Scotland strategy is, says a government aide. I thought at last we have a clear position, but perhaps not, the Mensa minister following Lewis's departure. Boris Johnson had previously seemed to be all on board with the Lewis strategy to apply to Scotland the methods of the Vote Leave campaign, which he believes not only changed Number 10 but delivered the Brexit deal. The new union unit was to be modelled on Task Force Europe, the small and agile team of a few dozen officials who assisted the Prime Minister through the second half of the Brexit negotiations. There would be about 40 people operating under a strong command in Number 10. The Scotland office would implement decisions made centrally. If the Scottish Tories quibbled, they'd be brought into line or bypassed. The flaw of unionism, feuding and split leadership would be remedied, according to the proposals. Rather than take inspiration from the Better Together campaign in the last referendum, it would closer resemble the Business for Stirling campaign and aim to stop there being a referendum in the first place. When it comes to the approach to Scotland and the Union, the Prime Minister is also taken by the idea that Brexit has given him a new weapon to fight for the Union, the controversial Internal Market Bill. passed to give the UK government new powers to handle the Brexit transition and powers to get more involved in Scottish affairs. For example, the Prime Minister could say that Glasgow drugs deaths are surging, so the UK government is willing to fund treatment centres or other initiatives that could be carried out by the City Council. The idea is that Scottish local authorities can bid for Westminster funds to carry out work that might not be funded by Edinburgh. The overall idea would be that Scots would soon see two powers in the land. The Scottish government would have its transport, health and education departments, but they would no longer have exclusive control over public services. The UK government would be there too, stepping in to provide extra help or mop up after Holyrood failures. The Prime Minister is thought to be strongly supportive of this plan, seeing it as similar to the tactics the EU used to ingrain itself as a government within nation states. Several ministers favour the clarity of this approach, arguing that 14 years of power have seen the SNP unable to handle sturdy opposition. Their defensive muscles have atrophied, says one involved in recent policy. We can love Scotland but attack the Nats, they'd be discombobulated. Simon Case, the new civil service chief, is also thought to have backed the idea, though he keeps his cards close to his chest. As a former Buckingham Palace aide, he would not enjoy telling the Queen that her kingdom had been the latest casualty of Number 10 chaos. Case is like Varys from Game of Thrones, explains one colleague. The show has a cult following among senior Tories. In one episode, Varys is asked who he really serves. His reply, "I serve the realm, someone has to." This is understood to be Case's approach. He is in no doubt about the threat to the realm and the danger currently posed to it. While there is general agreement on the nuts and bolts of the strategy, there is disagreement on tone. Aberdeen-born Michael Gove is keen on a less combative approach. The idea is that you catch more flies of honey than vinegar, says one figure involved. Project Love, as some have come to call it, would focus on the positive impact of the union, highlighting the UK successes such as the vaccination programme and furlough scheme. Internal polling has shown more support in Scotland for such schemes, as well as the idea of more cooperation. This is one of the reasons there are reservations about a more confrontational tone. The idea is that it's about fighting smart, with a more diplomatic approach being the more effective. With Gove in conversation with Gordon Brown, among others, and said to be in listening mode, some of his colleagues, however, worry the approach could soon become too clever by half. There's talk of a review of the constitution, or a look at devolution from a UK-wide perspective. Gove, for his part, is getting ready to battle, and has changed his Zoom name to 1707, the year the union was founded. The Prime Minister's allies and enemies alike all agree that if he loses Scotland, he loses power. And this failure will eclipse any of his successes. No one doubts his passion for the union. He continues to see great political power and infrastructure projects, such as the proposed tunnel between Scotland and Northern Ireland. But as one Scot Tory puts it, that would not be the top of Scottish voters' list when it comes to a spare £20 billion. Especially if one of the arguments against the referendum is that it would cost £100 million. The Scottish Conservatives are keen to ignore the current Number 10 drama. For many Scot Tories, the union unit has become an unhelpful distraction that the SNP could seize on, and they have campaigning to get underway. Douglas Ross, the Westminster MP who now leads the Scottish Party, has a weekly call with Gove and Scotland Secretary Alistair Jack, where they liaise on issues. As for Number 10, many in government believe there will be no new union head appointed, officially at least. But changes are afoot. I understand that the Prime Minister intends to convene a new cabinet committee devoted to developing strategy to save the union. Along the lines of the committee set up to plan for Brexit, he would chair this personally with Gove and Jack in attendance, along with the Chancellor, the Secretary of State for Wales, the Northern Ireland Secretary and David Frost, the Minister leading on EU relations and Brexit. There's also talk of the Prime Minister moving towards Gove's Project Love and away from his original point-blank refusal to hold a referendum on the grounds that the last was once in a generation. He might create wriggle room by starting to talk about the need to avoid a reckless referendum, a word which implies that while it's the wrong time for a poll now, that could change in the future. But if Sturgeon wins her majority, this could all soon be taken out of political hands and become a matter for legal minds, the courts and civil servants, who could start preparing for the eventuality regardless, given that the SNP are likely to push for a referendum, whether or not Westminster allows it. It could soon become more about legal cases than political strategy. As recent events have shown, the SNP is not invincible. Salmond has undermined Sturgeon's leadership and cracks are forming in party unity. But Sturgeon is strongest when her unionist opponents are divided. Johnson needs to lead and unite to stop flip-flopping between different approaches and making the same mistakes as his opponent.
That was Katie Balls, our deputy political editor, who hides her Scottish accent well. Next, Matthew Lynn.
Shops are boarded up. More than 4 million people are on furlough with little idea of whether they will have jobs to go back to. Global trade has hit levels last seen a decade ago, and government deficits are soaring, while most developed economies have seen output shrink by 10%, a collapse not seen since the Great Depression of the 1930s. On just about every measure imaginable, the global economy has never been in worse shape, and we are all a lot poorer. And yet, here is a puzzle. We can't see any evidence for that in the financial markets. Instead, we are witnessing a series of extraordinary, epic bull markets. Cryptocurrencies finally took a dive this week, but Bitcoin has quadrupled in value in recent months. Tesla is worth more than Toyota. Commodity prices are racing upwards, and small day traders are taking on the big Wall Street hedge funds, sending prices of obscure companies through the roof. The apocalypse has never been so profitable. Welcome to the strange looking-glass world of what is starting to be referred to as the upcrash. Even as the world grapples with a pandemic, asset prices have been exploding, and anyone riding those trends will be making a lot of money. Crazy? The market's behaving in ways that are even more unhinged than usual? Well, there may be an element of truth in that. And yet, the upcrash is also completely explicable, even if not entirely rational. Powerful trends are coming together. The global policy elite has formed a consensus on a version of free-spending Keynesianism that's not been seen since the 1960s. Technology has been accelerated by the pandemic, disrupting old industries and creating new ways of working at lightning speed. And the markets have a whiff of insurrection about them, as new players usurp the traditional bastions of financial power. The result? Prices are moving very, very fast. A few examples illustrate how wild many different markets have become. Last week, Bitcoin was trading above $50,000 a unit, up from $5,000, yes, that is the right number of zeros, a year ago, and the currency is now collectively worth more than $1 trillion. Tesla is worth $670 billion, more than Toyota and Volkswagen, the world's two largest auto manufacturers, combined. The obscure computer games retailer GameStop saw its shares soar from $20 to $330 as hordes of small traders talking to one another over the web piled into the stock, taking on the hedge funds that were selling it short and beating them at their own game. New listings of companies are accelerating all the time and attracting sky-high valuations. Bumble, the woman-focused dating app, saw its shares soar 70% on the first day of trading, netting a $1.5 billion fortune for its founder. There is a mania for what is known as special acquisition companies, or SPACs for short, which list their shares with the sole purpose of buying other businesses, usually unknown. Almost purely hype, Augustus Melmoth's South Central and Pacific Mexican Railway, in Anthony Trollope's classic satire of city speculation, The Way We Live Now, was a model of sober investment by comparison. 250 were launched last year, raising a combined $83 billion. Another $20 billion was raised in January alone. For what? No one really knows, but the money will have to be spent somewhere. Overall, the bull market that started after the March crash has been the fastest since the recovery of 1932. The S&P 500 is up 75% since its low point, just below the 78% rise in 1932, but more than any of the other 12 bull markets since then. The total value of all the quoted equities in the world has hit $110 trillion, the highest on record, and equal to 126% of global output. Yep, you guessed right, that's an all-time record as well. The value of the global bond market this month hit $67 trillion, another record. Green energy is going crazy, with Invesco's solar ETF up 400% in the past year. PayPal, with a market value of $310 billion, is level with the mighty MasterCard after briefly overtaking it. The space exploration sector, perhaps the ultimate frontier market, is buzzing with activity. And who can blame anyone? This planet often seems past its sell-by date, so heck, why not try another one? Elon Musk's SpaceX is now valued at $74 billion after its latest funding round, while shares in Richard Branson's perennially optimistic Virgin Galactic have tripled in the past year. The last crisis produced a bubble in the price of sports cars. Now it's sports cards. One of Michael Jordan trying his hand as a baseball star sold for $712,000 this month after trading at just $200,000 a few months earlier. There is even a trading platform where you can speculate on the value of the cards. The list goes on. With economies in lockdown and with GDP taking its worst hit since the 1930s, we are all a lot poorer than we were a year ago. So why the exuberance? The most immediate cause is the fact that we're experiencing a stimulus on an epic global scale. Central bankers, finance ministers, academics, think tanks, and the International Monetary Fund and World Bank have formed an ultra-Keynesian consensus. We have not been in this territory since the 1960s, with wild spending on moonshots, the Vietnam War, and lavish social programs. President Joe Biden has promised a $1.9 trillion blast to lift the American economy out of recession and create a green revolution. His plan includes sending a $1,400 check to everyone earning less than $100,000 a year. In effect, free money. Canada, the most sober of nations, is racking up the biggest deficit in its history. On this side of the Atlantic, the EU has started issuing debt for the first time, with its €750 billion coronavirus recovery fund. Germany, traditionally the most frugal of major economies, is debating easing the debt brake, which puts a constitutional limit on deficits. France is about to overtake Italy as the third most indebted nation in the world. Here in the UK, we may see the free spending of the Johnson government as typical of the Prime Minister's personal brand of flashy, big project boosterism. But in fact, as in so many other ways, he is a fairly conventional politician who is simply doing what everyone else is doing. Our spending is fairly modest by what are now global standards. It's not as if anyone was being exactly frugal before the pandemic. The Federal Reserve's balance sheet, in layman's terms, basically the amount of money it has printed, this month hit an all-time record of $7.5 trillion, or 35% of US GDP. Overall, the money supply in the US, M2 in the jargon of economists, has risen by 24% in the past year, the largest annual increase since 1943, when America was paying for the cost of fighting the Second World War. The European Central Bank has gone much further, expanding its balance sheet to €7 trillion, which is 71% of the zone's GDP. And to round out the Big Four, the Bank of England is on a relatively modest 36% of GDP, while the Bank of Japan is ahead of everyone on 126%. We are surfing a tidal wave of easy money. Total global debt, according to the Bank for International Settlements, rose by $24 trillion last year to an all-time high of $281 trillion. Between them, governments, companies and householders now owe 360% of GDP, compared with less than 200% a decade ago. Is anyone worried about that? Not really. A few economists have rung alarm bells. Larry Summers, Bill Clinton's Treasury Secretary and a former president of Harvard, has fretted publicly that Biden's plan is too big, but such concerns are quickly drowned out. In the wake of the crash in 2008, governments bailed out the banks and ran up big deficits, but they also embarked on austerity programs to clear up the mess. This time around, the consensus is to spend, spend, and then spend some more. Moreover, the pandemic has telescoped a decade of technological change into a single year. In January, the Office for National Statistics reported that 36% of retail sales were online. A year ago, it was less than 20%, almost doubling in a year. Netflix has been adding 16 million subscribers per quarter. Zoom's peak meeting numbers hit 300 million last year, which is a heck of a lot of sales presentations and employee reviews, compared with fewer than 10 million in 2019. The market for streaming concerts is now worth $600 million a year and growing fast. Office rents are collapsing as companies decide they don't need that expensive space anymore. Department stores are being converted to apartments. Locked up for a year, we have converted to working, shopping and socialising online, and it doesn't look like we will ever go back. The result? Whole industries are being turned upside down in the blink of an eye, and that creates vast gains for the entrepreneurs who are in the right place. The GameStop saga transfixed traders because they could see power shifting from the big investment banks and the asset managers and hedge funds in their orbit to a new breed of app-empowered small traders. Individual investors were a forgotten force for a century. No one cared what they thought. During the past year, they have come storming back, moving share prices and determining the direction of markets. Robinhood, the tellingly named app favored by millennial traders, added 3 million traders in the past year alone, and its rivals have seen similar growth. Angry, chippy, and vengeful, the online traders are more like a furious mob than mainstream investors. At the same time, financial power is shifting from Wall Street to Shanghai, as China's rapidly recovering economy eclipses the US. Who's in charge? And who does the Fed chairman or the governor of the Bank of England call for a quiet word? No one really knows anymore. The result? The voices of calm have been silenced. Where will it all end? We have seen up crashes before. An epic bull market started in 1932, even as the Great Depression ground on and the world headed unstoppably towards a global war. The Long Depression, the slump that lasted for the last three decades of the 19th century, also witnessed railway and emerging markets booms. Easy money, technological change, and rapid shifts in economic power between continents are a potent combustible mixture. And yet the upcrash of the 1930s ended in war, and the consensual ultra-Keynesianism of the 1960s ended in the stagflation and chaos of the 1970s. Once the pandemic is over, we are meant to be heading for a new roaring 20s as economies flare back to life, a rerun of the Great Gatsby era, but with less jazz, more Teslas. It's not impossible, but history suggests that a chaotic or catastrophic ending to the boom is more likely.
That was Matthew Lynn, and finally, the great Craig Brown.
A while ago, Samantha Markle declared that her forthcoming book would be about the beautiful nuances of our lives. Was nuances a misprint for beautiful nuisances? Or did she have a change of heart? Either way, there isn't a beautiful nuance in sight. Instead, it is like a blunt object found at the scene of a crime. As royal memoirs go, it is by far the most macabre, and perhaps even loopier than the Duchess of York's book, Finding Sarah, A Duchess's Journey to Find Herself. By the third page, Samantha already has her knives out. The first person to get it in the back is her own mother, a forgotten figure who met Thomas Markle on a blind date. Rosalind was 5'9", had red hair, was not shy, and was quite available, writes Samantha, who employs inverted commas like rubber gloves to insulate herself from what she is saying. She adds, although she was not his first preference, she would suffice for him, as he was a typically hormonally charged male. He enjoyed the fact that she was promiscuous. A few pages later, we learn that when Thomas was away, Samantha's mum would have private time with one of her male acquaintances. Rosalind is apparently alive, though, like so many people in Samantha's life, Samantha isn't speaking to her. She and I never got along, she writes, and she was incredibly bitter that I favoured my father. Nor does Samantha have much time for her mother's mother, whose apt surname was Loveless. Her father's father also gets a seeing to. As a child, Samantha, or Yvonne as she was then, just happened to be rootling around in her grandparents' bedroom when she found a trunk full of Playboy magazines by the side of the bed. The discovery, she says, made me resent my grandfather. But, ever the saint, I didn't want to cause problems between them, so I just said nothing until I could discuss it with her privately some day. Or indeed publicly, in a book. Samantha's parents split up, and her father then met and married Doria, 15 years his junior. She had a great smile, recalled Samantha, but I'd heard somewhere that if a person smiles all of the time, be wary. Lucky then that Samantha has yet to meet Her Majesty, who is nothing if not smiley. Samantha's complaints against her stepmother are niggly, but no less forceful for that. I was uncomfortable seeing her smoking and wearing a bathrobe in the front yard. When Samantha is 16 years old, Doria, with an interesting Cheshire Cat grin on her face and a triumphant tone in her voice, tells her that she's expecting a baby. Samantha's reaction is unusual. I wondered if at any moment, like in the movie Aliens, something would pop out of her stomach. From this point on, she focuses on Meghan. Throughout, Samantha attempts to portray herself as the big-hearted older sister, always being let down by the willful little brat. But she has unwittingly written something quite different, a dark portrait of sibling hatred, red in tooth and claw, the perfect companion piece to Whatever Happened to Baby Jane. Resentment oozes from every line. Just before her first birthday, baby Megan throws blueberries around the kitchen as her father laughs in delight. "We didn't laugh about cleaning up the mess, though," adds Samantha. Towards the end of the book, she brings up the blueberry-throwing incident again. "I don't recall ever hearing Dad saying no to Meg about anything, and I couldn't help wonder what would happen if he did say no. I couldn't help but think that allowing kids to throw blueberries all over the kitchen wasn't such a good idea after all." Not for the first time, this passage found me wondering whether Samantha is off her rocker. After 38 years, who would still harbour a grudge against a baby for behaving just like a baby? Events or non-events fuel Samantha's burgeoning dislike of her stepmother, Doria. But when it comes to hard evidence, Samantha remains cagey. On page 73, she rootles around her stepmother's bedroom. "I came across something in the back corner of one of the drawers that shocked me into nausea. I picked up a small stack of photographs and I couldn't believe my eyes." What did these photos show? Samantha won't say, beyond the fact that "I wondered about some of the women in the photographs with Doria and grimaced over the implications." Playing the game of Twister with the brother of a friend, Samantha performs one twist too many and ends up pregnant, as one does. At first, the baby's father wants nothing to do with it, but then they get married and have another child before divorcing. The two little children are packed off to live with the father's parents in Virginia, while Samantha pursues her dreams by going to modelling classes, then to broadcasting school. Samantha keeps switching careers, model, actress, radio news presenter, but nothing lasts long. She quits her job as a news announcer because she can't go along with the station's attitude to the O.J. Simpson case. "I was talking about it so many times throughout the week that it seemed depressing, and I didn't think he was guilty, so I was feeling an ethical conflict." Meanwhile, Megan blossoms. Envying Megan's luscious long hair and olive skin, Samantha shells out on hair extensions and tanning beds. But it all goes pear-shaped. The extensions start to fall out, and she is left with several thinning areas. While Megan is flourishing at her posh high school, Samantha, now in her 30s, arrives back home. "Cooey!" On the first evening, Megan reminds her to put the lid back on the toothpaste. Samantha is so affronted that she's still going on about it 20 years later. "I thought, well, the Princess of Vista Del Mar has spoken. Whatever happened to respecting elders?" Samantha says she always wanted Megan to know that I was there, but perhaps that was the problem. Megan proved unresponsive. "I couldn't pinpoint it, but something about my sister's tone of her voice conveyed resentment." In fact, all the resentment seems to flow the other way. While Megan is bright and pretty and sparkling her way through an expensive college, Samantha is undergoing a horrible divorce from another unsuitable husband and trapped in a series of dead-end jobs. "I didn't think Meg really knew how great and blessed her life was," adds Samantha, "but I hope that she would someday." In 2006, Megan lands a job as a TV dolly bird, opening and shutting briefcases on the American version of Deal or No Deal. Unsurprisingly, Samantha is in two minds about it. "I thought Meg looked fantastic, but the first thing I thought was, they must have stuffed her bra. I knew there was a tape up there or something because she was not that busty." Megan then gets her big break on Suits. Samantha immediately suggests that, as she is doing so well, she should pay their father back some of the money he spent on her education. Megan says it's none of her business. "I didn't know why that would upset her so much. I thought she would say, yeah, that's the least I can do." Around this time, one of Samantha's daughters gets involved with an inappropriately older man. From this point on, the book reads more and more like Notes on a Scandal. Its sour narrator perilously out of kilter with the events she is describing. I said, "Let's talk about this." She went into her bedroom and slammed the door, and the next day I was given a restraining order alleging that I was abusive. Like so many people in Samantha's life, her daughter is no longer speaking to her. Of course, none of it is ever the fault of the saintly Samantha. I could only hope that moving forward, my daughter would apologise someday and find peace and happiness. The evidence indicates that Samantha last saw Megan in 2008. Neither she nor her brother, who, quelle surprise, she isn't talking to, received an invitation to the royal wedding, which was, she says, an incredible insult to our family. But who in their right mind would send a wedding invitation to an embittered relation they haven't seen for over a decade? But Samantha doesn't see it that way. She warns Harry via Twitter, "If she will treat our family this way, she'll treat your family this way." She welcomes a German company into her home to film her watching the big day on TV because I assumed that the world wanted to know how I felt about the wedding. Sad to say, she does not like what she sees. "When my sister and Harry looked at each other, it seemed like an oddly lacklustre moment. I kept looking at my sister's eyes and then Harry's, and I didn't see that joy and excitement." Whenever there are no fresh slights on offer, she is able to invent new ones, as if by magic. "I couldn't believe, after everything my father had given her, that she would deprive him of a traditional coat of arms." All in all, she finds the royal wedding rotten to its core. Samantha ends up calling Meghan a monster and cold-hearted and controlling. In a final show of strength, she sends her an email saying, "It must make you writhe in your own envious swill to know that all of your money and all of your manipulation did not win Dad all to yourself." What next for Samantha Markle? If ever they remake the film Misery, she must surely be a shoo-in for the crazed Kathy Bates character, swinging her sledgehammer hither and thither, hell-bent on paralysing the object of her obsession.
That was Craig Brown, and that's it from this week's episode. Now, before you go, on 6 o'clock on Wednesday, we're going to be hosting a live episode of Coffee House Shots, where James Forsyth, Katie Balls, Kate Andrews and I will be looking at whatever Rishi Sunak has in store for us just hours after it's published. If you'd like to join us, you can get tickets for £15 or £5 for subscribers on spectator.co.uk/budget. It's going to be an online event. Thanks for listening to this episode of Spectator Out Loud. I do hope you enjoy the magazine, and special thanks to our producer, Max Jeffrey.